Accession number 27083, Reel 10.
So, Henry, in order to be given any drink, you had to order a sandwich.
Yes, we had to order food. We didn't really want any food, so we got a sandwich.
Behind is the lubricant.
And it was a pretty sleazy joint, and we didn't much care for it. And we didn't like the clientele. No way were you going to dance. We'd already been soaked to the tune of something like 12 quid to get in by some huge trucker out in the doorway and so forth. And so we finally looked at each other and said, enough's enough. And back we went to Claridge's. And we were taken up to our rooms. And the door was thrown open. We went through a sort of lobby and through a sitting room into a large bedroom, fortunately with two single beds, beyond which was a most palatial bathroom of the sort where you step down into it as opposed to up and so on. And we were fairly tired by this time. And so we undressed and piled into bed and so forth, having arranged for a call at 11 o'clock next morning, which was Sunday. And 11 o'clock came, the telephone rang, knock on the door, in came a trolley laden with every sort of form of breakfast and every Sunday newspaper that was still going then, and so on. So we had some breakfast. We both had slight hangovers, and we weren't feeling our best. And time was rolling on. But we had to have a bath because of this gorgeous thing full of bells, buzz, and lamps and so forth. So we took it in turns, and we each had a bath. And by then it was about 12:30, and we had that rather sort of morning after, not terribly hungry for my lunch, slightly chilly feeling. However, we had to go through with this, and down we went to the restaurant for lunch. And there was a sort of four-piece palm court thing strumming away. And the restaurant was quite full, but it was full of grannies and godmothers and elderly and so forth. And there were no other naval officers present, so far as one could tell, and they were certainly nobody in uniform. And all the old ducks put up their starers to glare at us as we stumped in. By this time, we were increasingly beginning to wonder what we'd let ourselves in for. However, you know, it probably meant prison, and so we might as well have some lunch to make it worthwhile. And so we ordered, I remember we ordered a bottle of Chablis and dressed crab, which I think probably wasn't the best choice for our digestion, but never mind, that's what we did. And we got through that. And by this time, our conversation had somewhat lapsed. And not to put too fine a point on it, we were absolutely shit-scared as to how we were going to extricate ourselves from this situation. And we didn't have any pudding, and we asked for our bill to be, we gave our room number and asked for it to be put on our account and that sort of thing. And feeling by now absolutely petrified, we stumbled out to the cashier and demanded our bills. And wondered what form the arrest would take and what the next move would be. And I can't remember exactly what the figure was. I think it cost us 32 shillings each. Something like that. And the whole thing had been fixed by somebody. I don't know. So evidently the message had got through to the receptionist from that before. Unfortunately, I didn't leak this at all. so I can only suppose that my chum did. But it did leak. And the buzz got out. And we had hell for the rest of our subs courses. And our colleagues would say, there's no point in going ashore with Leach and Bennett. They only go to carriages and all that sort of skylark. But anyway, that was that.
Just to give some perspective on this, what was a sub's pay?
Oh, I'm very bad at that. I don't know. I can't. I mislead you.
Okay.
It wasn't much then. And at the end of those subs courses, I was appointed as sub of the gunroom to the battleship Duke of York. Sub of the gunroom being a term in that it was a big gunroom. She was the flagship of the home fleet. We had, and I'm talking now the spring of 43, we had 43 in the gunroom, which was a large size. 10 of them were sub-lieutenants.
And 33 midshipmen.
Hmm?
And 33 midshipmen.
Yes. One of the midshipmen, an R&R one, had already been subjected to boards of inquiry in the Far East Fleet. They were a pretty ropey lot. One of the other RN subs was 2 years senior to me, but I was the sub of the gun, so I was the boss, I was the president of the mess, as well, and so on. They were a very mixed bunch, and there were so many of them that they didn't have enough to do, so they were bored, and so they didn't behave very well, and so on. As far as the officers were concerned, we had a very good lot, a super lot. The captain was George Creasy, who ended up as an admiral of the fleet. The commander, the executive officer, was Ruggie McIntosh, who ended up, I think, as he was something to the sergeant at arms in the House of Commons. I think. The gunnery officer was Desmond Drower, who died about a year ago, aged 93 or 4. Splendid man, ended up as a full admiral. The torpedo officer was a man called Clark, needless to say, Nobby. The snotty's nurse was a man called Desmond Ross, very nice chap. And the navigator was, he'd been retired and brought back. And the man called David Block, who later became a judge. Very nice man. A very strong, very good team. And a very good ship's company, too. And my action station was in the 14-inch transmitting station, computer room, and I was on the spotting plot there. And the officer in charge of the TS was a two-stripe dagger gunner. That's to say, he was up from the lower deck, whereas an ordinary gunner was of ordinary sort of intellect. This chap was clever, and he was a fire control gunner, as it were. Very talented man, and he wore two stripes. He would bring perfectly ordinary chamois leather to his action station for a defense watch. And in the course of about 3-4 hour watches, he would have transformed this chamois leather into a pair of kid gloves, beautifully stitched up, very talented. He produced on a board an array of knots made out of so-called Coston gun line, quite sort of thin line, most of which nobody recognised at all because it was way before their time and so on. He was very clever, very nice man, very much a prima donna, so you watched punts with him. But that was good, excellent. I was granted a full watchkeeping ticket, bridge watchkeeping, very quickly. And we had a very good team of harbour watchkeepers.
Can you explain the meaning of that term?
Watchkeeping?
A full bridge watchkeeping.
Well, until you had one, you were not allowed to keep watch on your own on the bridge at sea. It was as simple as that. And so you kept watch on the bridge at sea, but you were under somebody with a ticket until you got your own. That was it, really.
Yep.
But I got mine very quickly. And in harbour, we had... it was quite interesting. There were a lot of officers who were the flagship. And you could really divide the watchkeeping officers in harbour. They didn't all keep watch at sea. Or if they did, some of them went to the armament as opposed to the bridge. And there were really three types. There was the best type was, and a good example was the middle watch from midnight to 04, where life is pretty dead normally. And the best types would take over the watch from their predecessor and keep their watch out on the quarterdeck regardless, and go rounds from time to time and generally do what they should have done. The next best type would stay away, take out the watch, have a look around, find everything all right, find it rather cold, winter in Iceland, that sort of thing, go into the wardroom, switch on the fire, read the Illustrated London News, go out, pop out from time to time. And the worst type, and there were several, would take over the watch, not really pay any attention to what he's being told, go straight into the wardroom, switch on all the bars of the radiator, pick up a paper and go to sleep in a chair and never pop out, and so on. And so that was it. The senior watchkeeper was in fact an RNVR, a splendid man called Jimmy Nesbitt, and he was of the second type. And he'd just taken over the watch, he had a look around, all was well, and he we were anchored off in Belfield off Iceland at the time, and Jack Tubby was the commander-in-chief, and he settled himself down in his chair and turned the fire on and so forth, when the boatswain's mate, who was the sort of number two at leading hand level with a quarterdeck star, came in and said, "Officer Watts, sir, the commander-in-chief is on the quarterdeck in his pyjamas and wishes to speak to you." And Jimmy Nesbitt thought, Iceland, Valfield, middle of the night, blowing half a gale, bitterly cold, winter term. There was a, So he made some caustic remark to the unfortunate person's mate and said, "Get out and stand and watch properly." And moments passed, and in came later the quartermaster, who was a senior petty officer. Exactly the same message. "Officer Watts, sir, commander in chief, is on the quarterdeck in his pyjamas and wishes to speak to you immediately. And this Jimenez would go his top and say, what's the matter with you lot? And of course he wouldn't be such a goddamn fool as to be on the quarterdeck in his pyjamas, and here we are. Get out and keep a watch button. And he went back and picked up his paper. And a little time passed, and a young, smart Royal Marine, who doesn't remove his cap in an officer's quarter, but salutes instead, came into the wardroom, came to a crashing halt, saluted, and said, sir, the Commander-in-Chief is in his cabin and wishes to speak to you immediately. Slight pause. And, sir, he seems rather angry. And this poor RNV lieutenant, who was quite elderly and quite an efficient officer too, thought, you know, God, have I got this wrong? So he followed the admiral's orderly down aft to the cuddy and knocked on the door, opened it, and went in. And there was Jack Tully, who'd got a dressing gown on by this time, and glared at him and said, you asked the watch? Yes, sir. But why the hell's it taking all this time to blah, 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 and really let fly. And got under Nesbitt's skin. And he thought, well, there's any, I'm lost. I don't know what's going to happen now. But there's only one hope, and that is to go on the attack. A very good philosophy. And so he said, well, sir, you know, first the bosun's mate came along, and then the quartermaster came along, and they said the Commander-in-Chief is on the quarterdeck in his pyjamas, and he wished to speak to immediately. And, well, sir, here we are, anchored in half a gale, and it's the middle of winter, and it's freezing bloody cold, and we're just off Iceland, and, you know, anything more ridiculous would be absurd. Get out, said Tully. And he left. And he never heard what he'd been sent for about, nor did anybody else. going on. We were heavily involved, of course, in Russian convoys. Usually, if she's a nuisance, then you'll have to turn her off.
No, she's okay.
She's very special. Usually we were sort of standing off from the convoys to act as distant, heavy cover, and so on. And I'm just... Can we stop for a second?
Of course.
I just... And you know, it was good to be at sea because Scarpa was pretty boring, really, and we did quite a lot of time stuck in Scarpa. The captain was a very keen fisherman, and he used to take the first lieutenant and me ashore to what was called the mainland, but it was merely the largest island. Wasn't very good fishing. This was, of course, on a Sunday. When everything was quiet and so forth. And the water was fairly shallow inshore, and I hadn't got any gear with me at all, no waders or anything like that. And it was bitterly cold. And so your only hope was to wade in to about just over your knees, and you cast as long line as you could to get out, and it wasn't long enough. And when you were practically screaming with pain because of the cold in your feet, you packed it in, and the relief just to get out of the water, you've never caught a fish of any repute, and so forth. So that was one little activity there. Another one, which I used to hate, there was a canteen on Flotter, which was quite close to the main fleet anchorage on the island there. And the big ships companies would to and fro in drifters, driven by their owners or skippers, and so forth. And if the fleet was in, and much of it, as often as not, was, there were a lot of drifters, and crowded with liberty men who, I think leave expired at, I forget when, but not very late in the evening, and certainly not all night. And of course, Jack, understandably, was out to put as much down as he could in the time available, and did. So they were pretty, a pretty noisy, rebellious lot coming off. And you were in dead trouble if you were in charge of the drifter, as I was from time to time as a sub. You were in dead trouble if you brought the drifter back alongside with a lot of shouting, screaming liberty men. And you had to answer for that. And when you left the pier on Flutter by the canteen, the shore patrol would say, right, go, or whatever. And they'd all let go. And this dozen or dozen and a half drifters would all back off together. Absolute shambles. One nobody ever fell overboard and got killed. I don't know, but they didn't. It wasn't much fun, that. And then came the day when King George VI came up on a visit to the fleet in very good form, and he dined in the gunroom, and that was quite a moment too. Very easy to talk to and get on with. Couldn't have been nicer. Prince Philip then was first lieutenant of one of the destroyers. So that was a great occasion.
But at that stage, of course, Prince Philip was unknown to the royal family except through his own Greek royal connections.
Yeah, exactly that. There was no attachment, as it were.
No.
At all, no.
Can I ask what the Duke of York did? It helped escort the Russian convoys, I think you mentioned. What else did it do, or did it do? Was that its principal function?
It had done things. It had done some of the North African landings and had been out there. That was before my time, actually. I was there for 2.5 years, from 43 to 45. Then other snippets. One of the things, while the king was visiting, the fleet was in. And the fleet band, which we had on board, and they all had action stations in the computer room and that sort of thing. And they did ceremonial sunset that you'll be familiar with. And curiously, the king didn't seem to have experienced this before. And he was frightfully impressed. And he said, this is exactly what the country needs. We must get a film company out at once. And we'll do it again, and I will stay and see it's done, and that sort of thing. And early next morning, the majority of the fleet had to sail. So there was the problem over the mass bands, because we only had hours left. We couldn't get the film coming out any earlier, and so on and so forth. And the king stayed, and he went up and down from the cuddy to the quarterdeck 7 times by way of rehearsing and so forth. He was there taken with it. What use was made of it thereafter, I don't quite know. So we had a very curious principal medical officer, very senior surgeon commander, bog Irish. These were the bad old days, you know. These people were very good, certainly at the wardroom bar, and maybe on the rugger field. But God help you if they ever got at you medically, and so forth. And one day we went to action stations for real, And the armoured hatches in those ships were about 6 inches thick and very heavy, so that to lift them up you had a thing called a Weston's Purchase, which was a sort of a chain pulley, and so on. And you had to be very careful to take up the slack on the chain before you raised the securing clip, otherwise the chain would snap. If you made attention, somebody came on, and so on. And we went to action stations, and a young stoker hadn't got the drill quite right, and he hadn't checked that the slack in the chain had been taken up. And he raised the securing clip and pulled on the hatch, and it snapped the chain. And it fell across his ankle, which absolutely flattened it. And suffice it to say that the poor chap was screaming his head off. And at that moment, the PMO was heard to pass on his way to his action station in the sick bay. And muttered very audibly, rather sort of looking over his shoulder, "Oh, but Jesus, it is a terrible affair, send for the doctor." I had to serve under him twice more, and that was nearly a disaster. That's another story. And then one day I was sent for by the captain, Captain Creasy, who said that he'd checked up on my seniority and all that, and that I was due to put up a second stripe in whatever it was, 2 months' time or something. And what did I want to do? And he gave me two options. He said, "You can either leave and you'll go as number two to a fleet destroyer, or you can stay on here. And you can take over the forward four-gun 14-inch turret, and so on, and leave a frightfully senior lieutenant." And I was still a sub-lieutenant. "Which would you like to do?" And I thought, well, I don't know, if she really was a super ship, then this is the devil you know. Stay put. So I opted to stay put. In fact, my second strike, they'd worked it out wrong, and I wasn't due for it until the autumn. But I was relieved in the gunroom, moved up to the warden, still as a sub-lieutenant, which was really acutely embarrassing, because when you ask any of your chums from other ships to come for, say, Sunday night supper and watch the film, and you met them on the quarter deck and showed them into the wardroom, and you could see the sort of the glazed look come over their faces, and they didn't like to ask what dreadful thing had you perpetrated to have been removed from the gunroom and put into the wardroom. But there you were, and they took a lot of living down that.
When did you get elevated to the wardroom?
Lieutenant.
At lieutenant.
At lieutenant. Yeah.
And when was that then, in terms of date? So we just could.
That would have been the autumn of 43.
Thank you.
Well then, promotions were half yearly, at broadly Christmas and end of June, and at the next half yearly promotion. Next half year, I can't remember exactly which half year it was, and it doesn't really matter. But Tubby was relieved by Bruce Fraser, splendid man. George Creasy, the captain, was relieved by a man called Brian Schofield, but he was only with us for about 3 weeks because his wife was, I think, fatally ill. Certainly very ill. And he went and stood by her on compassionate leave. The commander, Ruggy McIntosh, was relieved by a strange PT specialist called Edward Tyndall Cooper, And none better than the sailor for sizing an officer up. And within 3 weeks of his arriving on board, I think I mentioned this earlier, Jack had nicknamed him the Screaming Skull, very aptly too. And the gunnery officer who replaced Desmond Dwyer was a man called James Crawford, who I think is still going. So I've got to be careful what I say, but suffice it to say that he was not of the caliber of Desmond Dwyer. And interestingly, the ship ran on. The ship's company was largely unchanged, but the ship ran on, and it ran on a sort of a flywheel action, the momentum having been given by the previous heads of departments. And that was very interesting. Then the next incident that came, the old battleship Royal Sovereign was handed over to the Russians, and she was refitted and not exactly re-equipped, but sort of tarted up with various Russian